Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The August 9th fatal shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed African-American 18-year-old, has reignited the national conversation on race and racism in the United States. A recent Salon headline reads, 10 Ways Racism Killed Michael Brown. The Huffington Post, From Michael Brown to Trayvon Martin, Racism Fueled by the Drug War. Business Week, Injustice in Ferguson, Long Before Michael Brown. And The Washington Post, Even before Michael Brown slain in Ferguson, racial questions hung over police. Tragedies like the one in Ferguson create opportunities to dig deeper into race relations in the United States, and then the conversation disappears from the national media until the next tragedy happens. Think about the conversation we had after George Zimmerman fatally shot Trayvon Martin on February 26, 2012 in Sanford, Florida. What has really changed since then? You could definitely argue that growing awareness of racial disparities in the prison system have taken place. But what else? What will it take to have a real conversation about race? What are different forms of racism, and how should they be addressed? What should we do about this? Joining us to talk about these issues is Dr. Shakti Butler, a filmmaker and founder and president of World Trust, a nonprofit that works to eliminate racial injustice through transformational education. Shakti is the producer and director of several acclaimed documentaries, including her latest, Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity. She uses interviews, story, theater, and music to illuminate structural and systemic racial inequities. And Shakti joins me in studio. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. So you spend your days traveling around the country talking about these issues. And I know that you like to really talk about the system involved as opposed to these horrific tragedies. But what do you think about the national conversation we're having now because of the shooting of Michael Brown?
I think that when these shootings happen, it's a way for people to take stock of what's going on and have a conversation that they don't normally have every day, necessarily. Of course, there are other places where people do have this conversation every single day. When we are aware of injustice, I think what it does is it creates an opportunity for us to either do something about it or not. If we don't talk about it, of course, it stays hidden. So I see this as, you know, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And how do we have a conversation that actually allows us to understand and to analyze why these things keep happening? This is not new.
How do these things affect your work? Because you travel to schools, you speak to students about racism and racial inequality. What goes through your mind when there's yet another shooting?
What goes through my mind is something that I've known since I was a very little girl, mm-hmm. which is that people, because of the color of their skin, are treated differently from other people. And that very basic fact is denied by people who don't have the experience of having to teach their kids how to behave when the police pull them over, what they should do when they're walking through a store and they're being followed, how it is that they're treated in school, who ends up on the blue bench in the principal's office. You know, these are things that are not new, and so they're not a surprise. What I look at is somebody who is willing to engage because they are finally having to admit that there is injustice.
Talk a little bit about your background. You're African, Arawak Indian, and Russian Jewish.
Yes.
And you give a lot of talks, and you say that the first time you realized that the first time you noticed race is when you were the only person of color at a private school from third to eighth grade.
Right. How'd you find that?
I listened to a few of your interviews.
I grew up in Harlem in New York, and we lived in Harlem because my mother's family disowned her when she married my father. And so my whole world was really in the African-American community. And when my parents decided that I should get a better education and they sent me to private school, I realized that I didn't belong there. And even at the age of eight, I understood that I had one experience when I was at school and another experience when I came back home to my community, which was a community. And I learned how to navigate those two worlds. And it was just part of my everyday.
And because you're so light-skinned, mm-hmm. you also talk about the fact that people often don't know what you are.
Right. And so I do have light-skin privilege, but I was taught as I was growing up that the job of people who can pass or have more advantage is to hold open the door for people who cannot. And so I've always been firmly entrenched in my responsibility to build equity, to be able to speak where people can't speak, and to use my voice and whatever else I have to move towards justice.
At what point did you decide that we cannot make change unless we really understand how the system works? This isn't about whether you are a good person or a bad person,
right.
but you say it's really about the system.
Right. So often when we engage or we hear a conversation about race, it kind of goes like this. If it's a white person who's speaking, they'll probably say something like, I'm a good person, I don't see color, or something that kind of negates the experience that they have not had growing up. I'm going to say what the system is because I think that's important for people to understand. The system, if you think of it as an infinity loop, is embedded in history and culture and identity. At the center of that infinity loop is the space where we talk about power and economics. That's what moves the system. The internal components are bias, privilege, and internalized racism. And those experiences play out on our relationships that are interpersonal, institutional, and structural. All of those things are going on at the same time. And it's so much deeper than I'm a good person and I don't see color. We do not understand our history in this country. We do not understand the need for our economy to run on the backs of people who will provide cheap labor. That has been consistent in the history of the United States. And it is continuing. And so if we don't look at this systemically and see how the internal and external components are related, and if we don't understand structure, then we can't possibly change it.
How do you start this conversation about the system with the very people you're speaking about?
I show them film. It's interesting because, you know, my husband is a very talented and gifted filmmaker himself. And he's a documentary filmmaker. And we would have conversations about the way that I approach making film. My experience is that you need to have critical mass. You have to have lots and lots of voices telling the same kinds of stories before somebody will go, wow, I can't just dismiss that. You know, I have to take it in. And so I interview lots of people and I organize it based upon themes so that people can actually hear many different perspectives. And that allows people to engage in conversation that's not just about them. They can take the experience that they have and use it as an entry point into understanding something that they're a part of.
What would you say is most effective? Because in your film, you've got great stories about how one woman was at a grocery store with, I believe it was her half-sister, and one was black and then one was light-skinned. Mm-hmm. And the one that was light-skinned wrote a check and the cashier was fine and everything was great. Have a lovely day.
Right.
And then the one that was black wrote a check and the cashier was not nice to her and she wanted to see two forms of ID and then she wanted to see if she had a bad check.
Right.
And everybody around, and then the light-skinned woman came over and said, why are you doing this? You didn't do that to me.
Right.
And everybody around was around her was affected by that.
Right.
So do you think that is the most effective way to reach people? Because what we often do, especially in the media, is throw out these statistics.
Right. I think we need it all. I think every time you have an opportunity to make an intervention that actually shifts something that's going on that's not correct in the moment, and the policies that get changed, you know, because people have organized to make those changes, all of that's necessary. But ultimately, you know, we have to change the consciousness of the average person so that people can come together. I mean, I feel like the work that we're doing is really about movement building, mm-hmm. that you can't engage in movements unless you really understand what it is that you have to fight for. And certainly, we have to fight for equity. The most interesting thing to me is study after study has shown is that when social justice issues, and I'm talking about race, but this could be gender, class, it doesn't really matter what it is. The system works the same for all of them. When we want to actually build equity, let's say we want a school to be a stellar school, we have to have different kinds of kids. We have to have different kinds of teachers. We have to have people of all different class backgrounds and experiences in order to make the environment rich and to produce the kind of learning that we're looking for. The same thing with neighborhoods. Social justice has to be at the core of what we're talking about and what we're doing, or we can't make change.
And also, when we have these conversations, it's easy to say, the Michael Brown conversation will most likely disappear in a couple weeks until someone else is shot in the national media.
Right.
But you point out that there's so much work happening on the ground and people doing really amazing things that doesn't get as much attention as
Correct.
It would,
right.
right, unless there's a tragedy.
It doesn't get that much attention, period. It pops up sometimes. I mean, you'll have people who can come on the radio or be on television or who write commentary who talk about this. But what I'm talking about when we discussed this for a moment before is that it's very important for us to begin to note in the media where we tell stories that there's lots of good work that's going on a daily basis, and we have to connect the dots among all of that good work that's happening. Otherwise, it's very easy to say, oh, this story comes and it goes. I don't really have to do anything as an individual. I certainly don't have to work with other people to make change. And that's not the impression that we want.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Shakti Butler, a filmmaker and founder and president of World Trust, a nonprofit that works to eliminate racial injustice through transformational education. Shakti is the producer and director of several acclaimed documentaries, including her latest, Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity. And you can find links to Shakti's work at yourcallradio.org. Definitely be sure to watch the trailer of Women Talking About Race. And today, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the conversations that you're hearing and having about race and racism? And what do you think about Shakti's overall argument that we really need to focus on the system, and that's the only way that we can address change, or find real change? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org.
I just want to make one clarifying remark. I think we have to understand how racial inequity and all forms of inequity are systematized. It's not that just by understanding how the system works that will make a difference in and of itself. But usually the conversation is so shallow that we can't really begin to look at, well, what kind of strategies are we going to use in order to make change? How do we analyze what's happening? That's what I'm talking about. We have to analyze it and we have to strategize for change.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, since the conversation usually takes place at the personal level, that really doesn't do a whole lot for systemic change. So if I said to you, for example, you know, let's get together with all of our friends and you know that school down the street or across town or wherever it might be, let's pull all of our money together and let's fix it up. And we do that. We raise a lot of money. The school is painted. We know who goes to that school, by the way. The school is painted. We have a brand new yard. There's a computer for every child in the school. It's all gorgeous. Why is it not sustainable? It's not sustainable because we didn't ask the people who live in the community to participate in the conversation about what would make a great school. We don't look at the tax dollars that are not there to pay for that school. We don't look at the relationships with the media and the press for that school. We don't understand poverty. We don't understand poor health. We don't understand the parents who are struggling to live and, you know, don't have time to be part of the quote-unquote PTA. Or are unable for a whole host and variety of reasons. So we can't create something that's sustainable if we don't understand structure. And the structure of that school is really about the relationships that all play a part in forming that school. So that's what I mean. We have to be able to analyze what's going on. I can't just be a good person.
What comes to mind when I think about what has really changed over the past few years, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, it seems like there's so much more awareness about prison inequality. And I think about Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that? Because that seems to be getting a lot more attention.
I think it's wonderful to be able to have an issue that can help mobilize people to make change. And certainly when people can see something that is quote unquote unfair, and especially if they're kind of detached from it, on the one hand, they can promote change, but it also gives a platform for people who are working inside the prison system and working with the courts and seeing the rampant injustice that happens on a day-to-day basis. They can come together with other people who haven't really thought about it before. So it's an opportunity for us, again, to be able to delve into a little bit about why our systems work the way they do.
How do you, and we'll get to calls in just a minute, how do you deliver this message to people who say, but I really want to help that school. That's kind of all I can do.
Right.
And I'm putting my heart into it, and I'm trying to change something. But what else is there? What else can I do?
There has to be leadership. I mean, there have to be people who are part of wanting to change that school who can say, okay, we're going to have this conversation, but we need to invite parents and we need to make it good for those parents to be able to be there, maybe have daycare and food and so on and so forth. We need to go knock on doors. We need to invite someone who represents the media and the police and healthcare and so on and so forth. Who's at the table having the conversation? We need those different perspectives.
We have a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Lola in San Francisco. Hi, Lola. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. I'm in Oakland. First, I would like to say that by the time you got to my call, your conversation went in such an interesting direction. I do not want to detract too much from it. I would say that the key things that are, like, shining, first off, I didn't know Chuck E. Butler. Now I'm going to go look you up. are critical mass, leadership. Something I've been really interested in is the bystander response, which you were kind of talking about as it related to the Chuck story, in that we all have to, like, be willing to break out of that silent bystander part and be the leader. And what is it that makes people like that? It isn't throwing tons of money at it. In fact, the guy who started Facebook was not a leader type. They've been trying to make him into one. But who are the leaders in our community? They don't tend to be people who started off with a bunch of money. And so human capital is, and critical mass, and breaking through that wall of silence as bystanders, and like you do, Rose, volunteering directly, and that makes community. And I'm going to go look you up now. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Your response?
Well, no, thank you. I'm happy you're going to go look us up. I hope that we can be of service to your work in some way.
Well, thank you so much. You can find more information about Shakti's work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks, Lola. Let's go next to Julie in San Francisco. Hi, Julie.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm so enjoying this conversation, both on a personal level and a community level. And I have thankfully gotten past the point I heard mentioned a bit back in the discussion about being colorblind. I always thought, as a middle-aged white person who's been able to keep jobs easily, that I was doing a great thing by saying, I don't see color, nor do I see people being gay, nor do I see people being Christian. And I realized during your conversation how short-sighted that is. So I thank you for that opportunity to do a little painful growth in that regard. In San Francisco itself, there's a huge disparity, which is probably fairly well publicized, but in particular, our black neighborhoods have been shrinking or getting more difficult to live in. And we've all just been here seeing that happen and have not fostered the sort of community that's going to stop that. And I think that's our opportunity to try and reverse that trend. So thank you for your discussions, and I look forward to a little burst of energy from each of our communities.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate what you said. I think that the inner part of the job that we have to do to create a more equitable world is to really be willing to look at the places where we have been taught not to see. Because we've been taught that. We were born into a system we didn't create, and we're born into a history that we didn't create. But we do have to be responsible for changing it. So thank you so much.
Thank you again for calling, Julie. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. I'm speaking with Dr. Shakti Butler, a filmmaker and founder and president of World Trust, a nonprofit that works to eliminate racial injustice through education. Shakti is the producer and director of several documentaries, including Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity. And you can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What do you think of the conversation you're hearing and maybe having about race and racism? What else would you like to see? And then the main question is, what can we do about this? Let's go next to Robert in Berkeley. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Shakti. I was involved in a group called Healing Racism when I lived in Anchorage. Now I'm retired and I'm living in Berkeley, and I'm looking for advice on how to get involved in actively opposing racism in my community. Would you advise maybe on campus, because I'm a retired academic and am maybe on the wavelength of college students, or would you see other avenues as more fruitful, because students of color on the Berkeley campus are already, of course, somewhat advantaged vis-a-vis others in their community?
So, first of all, thank you for your commitment that you've had in the past and your willingness to continue that into the future. You know, there's so many ways that we can support what's going on in our immediate neighborhoods where we work, certainly with students. You know, I'm not trying to push my films here, but they're really great to show in order to get people talking. What came to mind is a friend of mine who belongs to a neighborhood watch community. So I don't know exactly where you live, but they have done amazing work on looking at privilege and unconscious bias and race disparities because of how the security responds to people who come into the neighborhood who, quote unquote, don't live there. And they have been raising awareness in a most amazing way. And I think that things that are small and things that are great, it doesn't really matter. It's just being able to be engaged and involved with wherever it is you see injustice that pulls at your interest level and your capacity to be of service. So you can't go wrong. There's lots to do.
All right. Thank you for calling, Robert. We'll take one more call before the break. Let's go to Levi in San Francisco. Hi, Levi.
Hi there. Well, my perspective is as a young 30-something person who is white, but grew up in San Diego and New Orleans in exclusively black and Hispanic neighborhoods. And with that one foot in, one foot out sort of perspective, I'm very aware of my white privilege, but have seen an astounding amount of institutional racism, whether it was toward students of color that I was in classrooms with. I could literally see myself being treated differently in third or fourth grade all the way till college. The University of Colorado, where I went, is an extremely white school that purports its own diversity. Clearly, there's a disconnect sometimes between leadership thinking they're enhancing diversity and then people at the ground level just really never feeling it. White people in general seem unaware of their privilege, and with a perspective like mine that's very rare, where the institutional racism seems so obvious, it's shocking to me as a child of the 80s and 2014 to see how little we've progressed, I think. But it really takes not a white person looking at the world from their perspective, but understanding that their perspective as a white person has literally nothing to do with the average human experience at all. Must break that down and decide to look at the fact that from fourth grade, I was required to put my race down on every standardized test, non-Hispanic, black, you know, white, Asian, Pacific Islander. We do a really good job of training children very early to look at color institutionally. That goes beyond the family. You know, we do tend
well,
to see
Levi,
color in the one who...
thank you for calling. Sorry to cut you off, but we're about to go to break, and I'll get Shakti to respond after break. I'm speaking today with Dr. Shakti Butler, a filmmaker and founder and president of World Trust, and you can find more about her work at yourcallradio.org.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation on the phone or by sending an email. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or you can call 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say, and at noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor, and our weekly presentation of Philosophy Talk.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about what students and parents need to know before they take out student loans. The average college graduate owes almost $30,000 in student debt. At the same time, tuition is up and family incomes are down. So what questions do you have about student loans? And then on Thursday, we'll be talking about the lack of diversity within environmental groups, with Dr. Dorsetta Taylor, a professor at University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and the Environment. She just looked at the top environmental organizations and found that they are dominated by white men. So we'll find out why this is and how things would change if those groups were diversified. Shakti, I'm sure you would find this really interesting. I saw you shaking your head there. Today, I'm talking about race and racism with Dr. Shakti Butler, a filmmaker and founder and president of World Trust, a nonprofit that works to eliminate racial injustice. She's the producer and director of several documentaries, including Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity. You can check out these documentaries at yourcallradio.org. There's also a really good one about women talking about race. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the conversation you're hearing and maybe having about race and racism? And what do you think about Shakti's main argument that we need to really talk about the system and how racial inequity is systemized? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What would a real conversation sound like? And then what should we do about it? I did want to ask you about a couple of statistics that are starting to come out and getting a lot of attention. This one is getting a lot of attention in the national media. In Ferguson, Missouri, a community of 21,000, the poverty rate has doubled since 2000. I mean, I'm seeing this at Business Week and a lot of economic outlets. A couple others in Ferguson, over 80% of traffic stops in the past 5 years have been of black drivers. That one's getting attention. And then blacks in Ferguson suffer an unemployment rate of 19%, nearly twice the national average, while the figure for whites is just over 6%.
Right. So you're describing how the system plays itself out. So I want to talk about being stopped while driving as a black person. One of the people who I really admire, his name is Dr. Muhammad. He actually is the executive director of the Schoenberg Collection in Harlem, which is the largest, has the largest number of books and poetry and literature written by African Americans. It's the greatest in the world that I know of. And he told a statistic, and because I'm from New York originally, I found this interesting, is that in 2011, the number of black and brown boys stopped while driving or walking or just being present was over 120,000. How many black and brown boys do you think there are in New York? Well, I'll answer that for you. It's 140,000.
Wow.
So we see that the percentages, and he talks about how this is a historical example of how history repeats itself. And if we think that driving while black or being in prison while black or brown and all those are something new, that poverty is not associated with all of this, then we don't understand history. Because during the Black Codes, of course, you still need to find cheap labor. Black folks were, and Native Americans and brown folks, scooped up off the street so that they could go work back on the plantation or in coal mines. So we don't understand history. History is part of the system, and we don't learn it when we're in school.
Have you seen any significant changes to the system since you've been doing this work?
Well, I think that the system, and when I use it, is really about having a frame for analysis. if you mean, do I see any change in terms of people's understanding and in rules and regulations and structural opportunities being, yes, there is change. But it also, because of poverty and because of poor health care and no opportunities to work, we're going to keep perpetuating what's going on, which is that there will be a majority of the people who are going to find themselves at the bottom of the economic scale and at the bottom of the societal acceptable scale. And unless we address those issues, then we can't really see change.
We have a question from Sarah who says, thank you. Would you please share your ideas about how a school district can address a rich school, poor school disparity? Some school parent organizations are able to raise thousands of dollars to fund extra tutoring, specialists, professional development. These are all personnel decisions that really help students succeed, especially in the younger grades.
Yes. Well, you know, that's such a big question, but I think that we have to start talking to one another. We have to start talking to people who are not like us and including them in on the conversation. What is it that prevents a school district that's doing very well or a school in a particular school district from being in partnership with a school that's not doing so well and being able to share some of those resources? Well, we're not really taught to think like that. You know, we can adopt a city in another, you know, part of the world and have a brother-sister relationship as a city. But what about doing it here where there's an economic consequence, meaning that there are students who suffer because there are no resources in their schools that can really help them navigate through the educational system? You know, there are many things we could do. We have to be creative about it.
All right. Thank you for your email, Sarah. And let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Anthony in Santa Cruz. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Butler, for speaking about this in such a positive way, because it definitely feels overwhelming and daunting to address the system. And regarding the bystander effect, I think that we're kowtowed. We're oppressed and taught to keep quiet and not speak up. Otherwise, we're called troublemakers, whistleblowers. We get fired. So that's a big part, and then of like trying to address such a large thing. And then the infinity loop was a great way of speaking about this, repeating history. If anyone wants to look up time wave zero, that's a great another thing to look at. Schools, you were just talking about schools and funding, and why doesn't that happen for joint stuff? Like, and I think it's because of testing scores being linked to money. Whenever you link everything to money, it just gets corrupt. And entropy reigns supreme, and all systems fail. And this capitalistic governmental society that we've created and have been trying to perpetuate, and we keep trying to push forward with wars, it's coming to an end. And we definitely need a lot of new things happening, and not just more laws, more fictitious rules we agree upon, but, like, totally different things. And it's a huge, huge thing to think about, so...
Well, thank you, Anthony, for calling in. You're right. It is a huge thing to think about. But when you do zero down, how, Dr. Butler, do you structure the conversation so all kinds of people will engage in this?
Right. Thank you for that question. The reason that I use film and use so many stories is that there is usually a story that will resonate with the viewer. And that's a step in through the doorway of change. When we talk about the places where we recognize an experience that we've had as part of a larger experience, then we can begin to have a conversation that really isn't just based upon everybody having the same knowledge, but it provides a frame where people can actually talk about their own experience, but again, tie it to the larger experience. And that's really important part of the process, because often we look at things in a binary way, or as the caller said before, we give bystander responses, when we have to begin to investigate more of how we are the same and we're different. And let me just say it one way, because I know I'm kind of going on here, but I think at the root of all of this is this rampant individuality. We are disconnected from ourselves. We are disconnected from each other, and we are disconnected from the earth. And part of having a conversation and building community and building ways that we can collaborate is about addressing the lie that we are just individuals. We are individuals, but we're part of something greater than our own individuality. And that's not how the society is basically thought of.
How do you reach out to people who do believe in that concept? Because that, I mean, especially with over the last 4 years, and we've seen a lot of racism under President Obama. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear this all the time. Well, get a better education. Go find a better job. It's easy. It's your fault because you are at Walmart making a really crappy wage. Right. I mean, you hear this all the time. How do you reach out to those people?
You know,
or do you want to?
Well, I think we need to reach out to anybody who's willing to be a part of a conversation as a start to actually being part of change. And I think of movement building as connecting the dots among all the things that people are actually doing that's moving towards change rather than being isolated incidents. Mm-hmm. You know what? I think I blew your question here. Can you ask me again?
No, it was just thinking about how to bring in people who believe in individuality.
I made it, and so therefore
you need to do it on your own.
They need to see something else. So one of the most wonderful things that I experience about film and the people who are in the films that I make are amazing people. And so I really give all of the credit to them in terms of how we end up with a product that allows people to hear something besides their own thoughts. So if I'm standing in front of a room of 800 people and they've watched a film and they're engaging with each other with all different kinds of lived experiences, my heart gets very happy. Because I don't really care whether you agree or you disagree, but you have to be talking to each other. And if we don't talk about it, if we remain silent, if we don't learn our history, if we don't understand how it is that unconscious bias works, then we can't make the kind of decisions we need to make about the kind of world that we say we want to live in.
Dr. Shakti Butler is a filmmaker and founder and president of World Trust, a nonprofit that works to eliminate racial injustice through transformational education. You can find links to her documentaries, including Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity, at yourcallradio.org. Be sure to also watch the one about women talking about race. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What would make a real conversation about race something with substance? And we've got so many statistics. What would actually create real change when we're focusing on the system that allows for racial inequity? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We have an email from Lita who says, one of the critical points I'd like you to address is the use and application of the term race. These are oversimplified, socially constructed categories that are used for the purpose of inclusion and exclusion. I feel that until this term becomes outmoded and acknowledged as irrelevant, we will perpetuate dangerous stereotypes and assumptions to continue to, quote, other one another.
Well, you know, I think that how do we get from here to there? I mean, the fact is that we know scientifically speaking, there is no such thing as race. But how did whiteness get constructed? There's a history to that. How does blackness and brownness get constructed? And more importantly, what are the meanings associated with those words? Certainly the level of poverty and economic disadvantage is real. Certainly when students get stopped walking down the street when they're in college in a primarily white town, that's real. So the impact of how we are configured racially, and I say that in quotes, is real. So what do? Eventually we have to change our language and we have to learn that's true, but we have to start where we are. And where we are is that we have tremendous disparities that are based upon racial difference that are quite real and have an impact on people's lives.
Thank you for the email, Lita. We have another email from Linda. Speaking of the power of film, what do you think has been the impact of recent Hollywood films on this issue? I'm thinking 12 Years a Slave, Lee Daniels' The Butler, 42, and even The Help and Precious. Are these movies finding a broader audience that might shift their perspective from viewing them?
Well, you know, I don't know what shifts people's perspectives. And I guess what typically happens for me is I'll go to a movie like that and I'm like, yep, that's true. All that's true. And the people who've never seen stuff like that go, oh my God, I didn't know that that existed, or I didn't know that that was possible. And then everybody goes home. And then what? So consciousness, raising consciousness is something that has to happen very strategically as well. And a movie, much like your beginning opening to this session, people will be engaged in, you know, this latest killing for a month, and then something new will come up. But it's the ongoing work. And I think what's driving what I'm saying now is that I think it's very important for us to ask questions. We come into conversations thinking that we know, and I include myself in that. But we have to begin to learn how to ask more questions, because it's in the asking of questions that new possibilities emerge. And that's what has to happen. We have to have other ways that we can see how the world is working. And without questions, that's not going to happen.
I was watching your documentary, Cracking the Codes, last night, and you were giving a lecture last year at I don't remember the university, but I loved how you did it, because you'd show a section of the documentary, right, and then speak and then have a dialogue and then show another section and another section. Right. What do you hear from students on these issues? What do they do once the session ends and they go home? Have you heard back from many of the students?
I do. I mean, I hear all kinds of things. I know that there are students who decide to commit themselves to social justice work. There are students who engage in, you know, all kinds of clubs or activities or whatever that they wouldn't have engaged in before. There are students who are resisting. One of the challenges, I think, is that on campus, on most campuses, you have a majority of white teachers. You have a majority of white students, unless it's a traditionally black college or something like that. And I see the patterns and the relationships the same. And what I mean by the same is people are focused on what it means to go get that good job, you know, have a family and live their life. And so any place where I see people coming together to kind of interrupt what it means to just take care of me and mine, and not totally immersed in the survival of the fittest, which is taught to us from day one, then that's where I find hope. And I think that's where some of the students find hope. But of course, it doesn't touch everybody.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for the email, Linda. And let's go to our next caller. Let's hear from Shan in San Francisco. Hi, Shan.
Hi, Rose. This is a great discussion. I'm touched because I grew up in St. Louis, at the outskirts of St. Louis, in Wellston. That's where most of the Jewish people lived. Then in the center of the city, that's where all the black people lived. And in the top of the hill, it was called Dago Hill, that's where the Italians lived. And the Germans lived in South St. Louis. And it was a difficult thing. I am in my crone years. I've left elderhood. I'm now experiencing my 85th year on earth. I have experienced prejudice. I think we can tap into, even in, like in high school, once I graduated, I couldn't get a job if I put down my religion because I was Jewish. So I had to work for a Jewish firm. So it's interesting. It was the teenagers, and I believe we will be saved, really, by people who are graduating now, because they're not getting the life that they've worked and slaved for and now are in debt for. Occupy was a great beginning, but it's just the beginning. But I think, as a high school kid, we all experience prejudice of some kind or another. If people would only identify how they are prejudiced against, it doesn't matter what color you are, you do experience it. And that's what I truly believe. It is time for people to be themselves. And unless we dig deep, we may not be here to talk about humankind.
Yes. Thank you. Well, you've lived a long life. It sounds like you've had a lot of experiences, and I appreciate your wisdom.
We love Shan. Thank you for calling in, Shan. We have an email from a listener who says, often as white liberals, we congratulate ourselves for having done something about race and keep going back to writers and speakers who confirm what we've already done is great. But the conversation is weak. Most of a memory of a palate-changing meal.
Yes, I agree. I mean, you know, it's I feel like the status quo is just that. It's the status quo. We get the same messages over and over again. We do need to dig deep. We need to ask a lot of questions. We need to really understand what creates inequity, whether it's a racial issue or a gender issue or a class issue or whatever the issue might be. We have to really talk about that in ways that go beneath the status quo.
Going beneath the status quo, what are some of the more difficult conversations we need to have?
I think we need to understand that we are capable as human beings of being horrible, no matter who we are, that we have the capacity for great good and we have the capacity for great harm. And because I'm right now working on a film on restorative justice, I really think that there's so much to challenge in terms of living in a very binary world. If you just pay attention for a few minutes to when people are talking about things, they'll usually position them as, is it this or is it that? And then you have to make a choice. I think we have to move towards developing our capacity to hold paradox. And unless we get to that place and we ask good questions and challenge structure, then we're kind of destined to repeat the same things over and over and over again.
What about our most basic prejudice? Because you talk with people in the film about this. What struck you the most about that? And how should we have a conversation about that?
I'm not sure I understand what you're referring to.
Do you believe that we all have
prejudices? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so what struck you about just the people that you've spoken with over the years about this? And how should we deal with that issue?
Well, that's kind of a funny question. It ties back a little bit to what I was already saying, is we have to acknowledge that we are capable of, you know, judging people in all kinds of ways about all kinds of things. In order to do something about that, we have to first acknowledge it. We have to look for ways that we can see ourselves, because we don't. You know, that's why we have mirrors, right? But people are our mirrors. And when somebody tells you a story and you go, oh, that's not really true, or you're being oversensitive, whatever, we have to ask what they really mean and be curious about their lived experience and see how we play out being the ones who can actually create harm ourselves. We all do. We create harm all the time. Mm-hmm. But we don't look at it. We go into denial.
I was struck by Julie calling in earlier, saying that and that was maybe 10 minutes into or 15 minutes into our conversation, and it affected her and made her realize that it's a little more complicated than just saying, I'm a good person.
Yes, absolutely. So much more complicated.
But that's pretty powerful for that to happen in 15 minutes.
Yes. And I think that's what happens when you have a chance to actually talk. And you're willing to hear. That's really what I'm referring to. You have to be willing to hear and to question and to sit with what other people say that runs counter to your own lived experience.
We've got another email from a listener who says that he or she has bookmarked worldtrust.org. What other writers and speakers can you suggest?
Oh, that's a great question. I love this question. So I want to make two referrals and two references. One is racialequitytools.org, where you can research to your heart's content. You will find all kinds of information on everything that has to do with equity on that website, and all great writers and books and articles and so on and so forth. The second thing I want to do is I want to mention an article that I just found that I absolutely love called the Strategic Questioning Manual. And, oh, God help me if I'm not going to remember her name right now. It'll pop back up. But the Strategic Questioning Manual by Peavey, really is about the process of asking questions for strategic change, for social justice. Believe it or not, that has to do with building a bridge from where we are to the unknown. We have to engage in questions. Good questions. Yeah.
You said you're working on a film now about restorative justice. We've done a few shows on this.
Yeah. I'm actually working on a trilogy which has social justice at the core. And the first one is on restorative justice. And the second one will be on hip hop justice. Mm. And the third one will be on earth justice, because they're related. Mm. The elements that create injustice are the same no matter where you go in the world. colonialism and what it's produced is the same no matter where you go in the world. And really being able to build a bridge to looking how to challenge these systems is what the work is, building movements. That's what we're doing.
What about this time gives you hope about where we're going? It seems like I was thinking about social media and mm-hmm. how people from around the world were expressing solidarity with the people in Ferguson.
Yes, yes.
And how that was not possible even 5 years
yes,
ago.
That definitely gives me hope. You know, being able to take a moving picture of injustice when it's happening gives me hope. Anything that allows us to be able to actually see something that we maybe don't ordinarily see or don't consider to be possible, even though there are people who will resist, it does allow other people who haven't made up their minds to actually consider something different. People coming together brings me hope.
And where do you want this conversation to go from here? Do you think this is a real teachable moment?
Absolutely. There's always a teachable moment. It doesn't even have to be a major crisis like this is. It's a teachable moment when you open your eyes and you see how other people live and decide that your humanity is engaged with theirs. That's a teachable moment.
There also was, I just wanted to mention another statistic. Mm-hmm. We talked about this earlier. Nearly two times a week in the United States, a white police officer killed a black person during a 7-year period ending in 2012.
Right.
This was a story from USA Today.
Right. And so, you know, if we didn't have video cameras and phones and so all of that, we wouldn't be hearing about this right now.
Mm.
You know, so that's where technology plays a role in what we're doing. We have to know the truth. And that's, I mean, it's not a shocker to people who grow up black and brown,
right,
or native for that matter. This is not news. It's news for other people who don't have this experience.
Dr. Shakti Butler is a filmmaker and founder and president of World Trust, a nonprofit that works to eliminate racial injustice through transformational education. Shakti is the producer and director of several acclaimed documentaries, including her latest, Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. And again, I keep repeating this, but I really want to see the one about women talking about race because the trailer is just fantastic. You can check it out at yourcallradio.org. Shakti, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Rose. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Students and parents need to know before they take out student loans. On the next Your Call, we'll open up the lines to answer your questions about the best options to pay for college. The average college graduate owes almost $30,000 in student debt. At the same time, tuition is up and families' incomes are down. So which student loans offer the safest repayment options and lowest interest rates? What are the responsibilities of a cosigner? And what questions do you have about student loans? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.